Take a network break. Grab a virtual donut and join us for our weekly review of tech news. We've got stories on VMware, Amazon, Broadcom, Cisco, and more. I'm Drew Conroy-Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow. Before we jump into the news, thanks to our sponsors. You can join the Packet Pushers in New York City on Monday, October 24th at the Loft Flatiron for a live event sponsored by Viptela to find out how SD-WAN enables cloud transformation. Go to viptela.com for details and to register. Another sponsor is Firebind. They're keeping your ISP honest. If good internet connection is critical to you or your customer's business operations, trust Firebind to give you the visibility you need. Check their website at firebind.com for more details. And thanks to IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial, go to itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code networkbreak30. Jumping into the news, a big story for this week is that VMware and Amazon are announcing a hybrid cloud service.
Everybody's running around like this is a surprise, but it was announced at VMware in Las Vegas. Remember?
I honestly don't remember, but
yeah. Well, in the keynote, we had VMware stood up and announced their cross connect, and thing, and a couple of other like hybrid cloud announcements. And I remember talking about it here, saying that, you know, it's the key thing here is that NSX allows these multiple cloud things to exist, and that NSX is absolutely the key to VMware breaking away from enterprise IT and finding a new market to sell its products in. So it's got it now that it's landed in the enterprise. You have to follow an expand strategy. The business people and the sales grunts call this land and expand. It's so intelligent, you know, obvious, right? So VMware has been looking for ways to go adjacent to the virtualization market, and its original attempts at building a software-defined data center that customers could host on hardware, it's had three or four attempts, really. If you sort of look back at, you know, vBlock was sort of one attempt. Then you saw the VxRail technologies and vRack technologies, which didn't take off. Then you saw converged announcements with HPE and Dell building, you know, certified racks to run the software-defined data center. That doesn't seem to have exactly, you know, lit up the market. And what we've really got is a situation where I think the hype around AWS is reaching such, you know, the smell, the fewer odor of AWS in everything that everybody does has sort of got to the point where I think everybody feels that what we did with Oracle 20 years ago, you know, we should all have an Oracle database. Why? I don't know. We should have one, right?
Or, so you feel like there's a lot of talk about going to AWS without necessarily a lot of good reason for it.
Yeah, I would generally say that there's a certain substantial percentage of enterprise IT CIOs who are not very talented, have very little technical knowledge and limited business capabilities to understand the risks of going into an AWS environment. And of course, the big one is they say, let's go to AWS. And all of a sudden they go like, well, we can't use VMware there. Oh, well, we've still got to go to AWS. Right?
Well, so, now they can.
Now they can. You know, I've told the boss we're going to AWS, and that's all he ever hears about. And so we have to go. So now they can. And VMware has effectively done a very interesting deal where AWS is bare metal provisioning the servers with VMware software.
Right. It's not an Amazon machine instance. This is ESXi running on Amazon servers.
Not just ESXi, but the whole stack.
Right. You've got vSphere, you've got vSAN, you've got NSX, and it's all managed from your vCenter environment.
That's right. So that vCenter interface that you know and probably love, and you've committed far too much of your personal time in mastering what should not need mastering. It should be quite straightforward and easy to use, but alas, it's not. They're giving you that interface. Now, you don't have to buy the software, you don't have to buy any of the machines, you just click a button and all of a sudden the taxation idea kicks it. Oh, rental? Is it rental? Taxation?
Rental. Let's say rental.
Let's call it, and AWS is bare metaling these things up. So you're actually building a vSAN, you're building ESX hypervisors and NSX networking stack between all of these, and boom, you've got yourself at a genuine VMware software-defined data center, as I understand it.
Right, inside an Amazon infrastructure, although it sounds like it's sort of set aside. I'm really not clear on the relationship between Amazon's full cloud service stack and this sort of walled garden of VMware on AWS.
So there's very little information, and we haven't been briefed or received any pre-announcement stuff. There's only a couple of blog posts. But the key data is that it's bare metal provisioning. So yeah. AWS says, oh, you want to build a software-defined data center, VMware, and it finds some machine somewhere in the infrastructure, and, you know, maybe it's a group of racks on the, you know, in the back corner, left over from some project. I don't know. Maybe it's a few thousand servers, which to AWS is not a big deal. And they're willing to light them all up, you know, and then boot them into a build, you know, standardized automated deployment stack of your data center is actually built there. Right. So it's not like you can light up one server. You have to go in and buy a software-defined data center, and it'll have to be a – I'm abstracting a little bit. To build a vCEN, you have to have a minimum number of physical instances. So my bet is that you need to buy at least 5 or 10 servers to build a vSAN, and then you build an NSX stack on top of that. You build your ESX, and then everything's all just automatically deployed. Boom, done.
Yes, yes.
And at some point, VMware and AWS have gotten together to, you know, this hardware will run with these drivers in this place, and these automation scripts work exactly the way that we expect them to work, and there's, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it's effectively, instead of what you would do today in a corporate environment is go out and argue with Cisco and HPE and Dell EMC sales reps and spend hours in meetings arguing over 15K RPM drives and what sort of MES cards you had got, and then, you know, wasting all that time futzing around, or, you know, and then ordering it and then waiting for it to deliver and then putting it in your rack. And you can just go to AWS, click a software-defined data center is built with a certain number of servers, and off you go, start provisioning.
That's right. And you can even make the order from your vCEN or console. You don't have to go to another window. You can do all the provisioning and buying right from one place. Very smart of AWS to set it up that way, you know, reduce that purchase friction.
So there's goods and bads here, right?
Yes. Now,
which one do you want to do, the good or the bad? Shall we be cynical or nice? First?
Let's start with nice.
Nice. Okay. So remember about 6 to 8 weeks ago, I said to you there's a rumor that AWS is producing a private cloud.
Yes.
And it has to produce a private cloud because the enterprise can't consume EC2 and doesn't really want to be fair. By and large, people have got VMware. They're happy with VMware. They kind of don't want to keep owning their servers because everybody says how stupendous it would be to just rent everything, which, you know, sounds like a really good idea until the higher purchase payment come in, until the higher purchase bill comes in. But that's not my problem. That's business people's problem. So this gives AWS a way to grow their physical infrastructure. Remember, every time they scale up, everything else gets cheaper and they make more profit. So it's the same warehousing concept.
Yeah.
Today, if you're buying 50,000 servers, well, now if I can sell by 80,000 servers, then the original 50,000 are cheaper in principle. Although there's a little voice in the back of my head, a lot of people saying that AWS doesn't need to reduce prices because it can't keep up with demand. But if it can't keep up with demand, how can it put Ada, you know, to do this deal with VMware? It must have spare capacity.
Right.
So there's a counter cyclical thing here that I'm sort of a bit, that part of the narrative doesn't make sense. So for AWS, it's good. Perhaps it's using unused capacity. And more importantly, once those enterprises are in AWS, they might start looking at all of the services that AWS makes the big money on, like S3 and global load balancers and internet connectivity and all that sort of stuff, right? So a sucker pack for customers. Come into my lair, said the spider to the fly.
Well, I found a blog from Enrico Signoretti essentially saying that he sees AWS as the winner here because that's the whole point. You sort of lure a customer who's very used to doing things on premises into the cloud. They get comfortable with it. They get familiar with it. And then they say, well, if we can actually run all our applications and move all our data into this cloud, why are we paying VMware all this money? So his take is good for AWS, maybe in the long term, not so good for VMware.
So all of the legacy companies are all about doing what the customer asks for, right?
Sure, sure.
And even when it's stupid, you still do what the customer asks for. AWS is not normally known for being stupid stuff. They normally do what's good for AWS and not what's good for the customer. But in this case, what VMware is giving is customers are saying, we want to be in AWS, but we want to use your software. So guess what VMware is giving them, right, is that?
Sure.
I think also that what there's some other sides of this is what VMware gets is the ability to turn around to HP and Dell EMC and Cisco and Lenovo and Huawei and all the other people who want to build servers for VMware's products and say, look, you guys aren't cutting it. Now we've had to do this. Now it's up to you to come up with answers that make deploying our software as easy as AWS. That's the new benchmark.
Ah, interesting.
Right? So if you look at what Cisco and HP and Dell EMC have not done, they have not been able to build, or their organizations really haven't been able to step up to the private cloud. We still don't have you know, hyperconverged platforms that are really as simple as, you know, what we're talking about here. They haven't solved the purchasing problem. We've still got legacy buying. It takes months to go through the buying cycle alone because vendors think that putting sales reps on seats makes sense, right? But all it does is add months to a sales cycle because people haggle over whether there's 20 lollies in the packet instead of 22 or something like that.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
And IT departments haven't gotten out of – they're not changing either. VMware, I think, wants to move so much faster. They want to accelerate the rate of change. They, you know, their first vCloud director wasn't very good. Software-defined data center is largely seen as not as good as it could be. And maybe, you know, VMware's got something to prove here. A, we can make it work with AWS. Okay, everybody else, why aren't you doing it? Mm-hmm. And also, look, you know, it's so simple to do. We can do this at AWS. Why haven't you got all this ready to go now?
That's an interesting perspective that they're sort of perspective. They're throwing this gauntlet down to their infrastructure partners on the private cloud side saying, you got to catch up.
Now, keep in mind that a lot of those other infrastructure partners are actually throwing their weight behind OpenStack.
Right.
Right. So we have, you know, Cisco going out and buying OpenStack companies to build its own OpenStack distro. We've got HP Helion as a private cloud OpenStack distro. We've got Dell EMC with their own OpenStack companies inside of there. They're trying to build products. So everybody is out there actually sort of eating away at VMware's business. So if you can go and put your product in AWS, where does that leave you, right?
Right.
That reduces the dependencies on the partners, you know.
Yeah. Well, so we talked about Enrico Signoretti saying, here's why it's good for AWS. And then there's a story on Medium from Cloud Opinion, if you follow him on Twitter, saying why it's bad for Amazon, because he feels like it's confusing that pure cloud story that Amazon was all about. He calls this a glorified colo strategy and says, quote, customers that buy into this partnership will end up wasting money and time and will not be moving to the cloud while paying the cloud premium. This is a screw your customer model that never works in the long run. And so I think his point there is that if you're actually going to put something in the cloud, you have to architect it for the cloud to take advantage of cloud capabilities like having an app mm-hmm. that's distributed across multiple systems as opposed to being tied to one VM and so on. And if you're just essentially duplicating your virtual environment inside AWS, what have you achieved? Not as much as you could if you actually just built an application for the cloud.
So enterprise IT is, you know, multi-trillion dollar market. What do you expect? Right. It's, you know, and they're not intelligent. They're not smart. People do not understand that you need to redesign your apps to run in containers or to run as stateless microservices across, you know, instances that can be shut down at any time. They just don't understand that. Right. And especially when, you know, for the last 30 years, people have outsourced any comprehension of technology. They went and bought an Oracle database and then Oracle tells them what hardware that should run on, whether it's a HP Superdome or a Solaris this or a, you know, x86 that. Mm-hmm. So customers have not had to be aware of this. They don't have the skill or the expertise, so they don't even know that this is a problem because they've just abrogated that responsibility away to a third party.
Right.
Now, there's a lot of Linux people who would take umbrage at that, and rightly so, because they've been using Linux. But the reality is that Linux still hasn't really penetrated substantially into enterprise IT. Most people are still using Windows of some ilk. You know, it's not uncommon for them to be running 15-year-old, 20-year-old, or worse software inside of their infrastructure. Lots of people still running Windows Server 2003. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, that's not cloud, all right? And telling them that you can't run that in the cloud is not something they want to hear. And that the people who are in the cloud are kind of at fault for this, for making such a, you know, dropping these little fart bombs all over the place about how awesome the cloud is and it's so much better and blah, 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 but never explaining themselves because it's actually quite difficult to explain.
Sure, that's right.
So, yeah, he's right. It's going to be a problem for Amazon because they're going to set the expectation. But keep in mind that those companies are now going to be able to build a VMware structure infrastructure straight inside of AWS. And there's going to be all of this S3 and, you know, serverless and all that other stuff is right there, right next to it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Think about that. So now all of a sudden, there's this really simple on-road to AWS services, and they can cloudify. It's all about where the data is. Once you've got, you know, your SQL database is running in a software-defined data center inside of AWS, well, you can build a serverless infrastructure over on the left that talks to that data.
Yes.
And then in 10 years' time, you can migrate off that Microsoft SQL or that whatever it is that's in, you know, background database that's in the back end and get rid of it.
That was exactly Enrico Signoretti's point as well, that this is, again, Amazon luring these customers in, getting them comfortable with the cloud, and in the long term, it's going to work for them. We should note that this is a beta program. It's actually not being rolled out until mid-2017, so we don't want to get our knickers too much into a twist.
Yeah.
And we're definitely going to be talking about this more as we get more details and more information comes out. But very interesting to see this happening. I'm still trying to figure out in my own head, what is the value to a VMware
and
customer?
And it's not an all or nothing. You're not going to pick up your entire data center and just move it to Amazon.
No.
You're going to build a software-defined data center inside of Amazon and start deploying new apps there, most likely. Or you might pick a couple of apps that are in your data center and move them out. And as soon as you move them out of your data center, you don't need to upgrade your legacy infrastructure because you've taken the pressure off. You've got rid of some storage. You've freed up some CPU cores. You don't need any more extra network switches. You've just moved it into the cloud. So this is this hybrid idea. So this is where the VMware's cross-cloud initiative that was announced in Las Vegas with, you know, using NSX to connect from, you know, your physical data center to a virtual one. As they said, they went with IBM SoftLayer at first. And then they said they're going to do it with the one that EMC bought, and now they're doing it with AWS. I would expect that you're going to see other companies do the same thing. Maybe Rackspace will be in on this in very short order.
Perhaps, yeah. Mm. I guess I see this as a way to sort of perpetuate your legacy application architecture with sort of a half-cloud approach, maybe because you want to get rid of some premises infrastructure. But if you really are going to go full cloud, then you need to. That's where new application development should be happening.
Well, keep in mind, you've got companies like General Electric, right? And they want to deploy Cloud Foundry. And it's very difficult to deploy Cloud Foundry on top of AWS, but it's very easy to do it on top of SDDC, as I understand it. Now, that said, you might also want to say, you know, you might have a CIO who actually wants to make some quite stupid comments like, we're all in with the cloud. I don't want to hear it. Everything into the cloud, right?
Right.
Well, now all of a sudden, there's a certain bunch of stuff that's in your data center that can't ever go to an AWS, Google Compute, Azure cloud. Let's not forget Azure in this stack, right?
Sure.
And how much of a competitive positioning this is against Microsoft's Azure. This lets them take those legacy apps and put them into AWS. So that
that's right.
You can have this, and this might be used to drive a fundamental change in your IT outlook. So instead of saying, no, the cloud's optional, you can choose in or out. No, everything's in the cloud. Now it's just a question of whether it's in a VMware software-defined data center on AWS or actually genuinely on an AWS EC2, S3, et cetera.
Right. All right. So let's leave that there for now. A couple more stories. Amazon and Microsoft Azure are both adding support for IPv6 in their clouds.
So speaking of clouds.
Yes, speaking of cloud, hey.
I think that what we're, you know, I've always been pretty down on and the whole IPv6 thing, saying it's still 5 years or 10 years away. There's been various moves recently. We talked a while back about Sky Networks in the UK enabled IPv6 on their entire retail backbone or broadband backbone, and Comcast is well progressed with it. And those are very large, you know, customers, very large networks, and it made a significant dent in the how much IPv6 there is in the world. But until AWS announces over IPv6, and now I've said that is, you know, pointless, because you might be IPv6 at home, but until those services are IPv6, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Well, this is AWS saying yes, almost all, only some of their services are now IPv6 enabled. So in this case, CloudFront, WAF, and Transfer Acceleration, which are the internet-facing services. Mm-hmm. So those are now IPv6 enabled. You've always – this various pieces of the infrastructure has been IPv6 before, but this is the part that's actually internet-connected. So now you can bring your public IPv6 addresses, and it might actually move the needle. Might.
It might, yes. And for Azure, it's most public Azure regions can now host dual stack, that's IPv4 and IPv6 VMs. So Microsoft hasn't upgraded all of its data centers to IPv6, but again, trying to move the needle.
Yeah, and the trick here is this, you know, like we've had IPv6 support in devices for 20 years, sort of. I'm exaggerating slightly, but, you know, 10 years at least. But the point is that there was always something in the stack that didn't do IPv6.
Right.
So while our routers did IPv6, our firewalls didn't. And then the firewalls got some basic IPv6 support. And then they got the full – and then all of a sudden we realized our IDSs don't have IPv6 support, and our proxy servers, and then our printers, and then our right? So it's not – so just because they've made an announcement that some services have made IPv6 available, that doesn't mean that IPv6 is all on, right? Instead, the floodgates are going to open and the game's over. It's all, you know, that, I don't see that. There's still plenty of stuff in AWS that isn't IPv6 and Azure, and they're only saying it's in some zones, under some circuit, blah, 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 all these limited – so it's still years away. Don't just start having a party. That's not Don't get right. overexcited.
Don't get overexcited. But it's a nice step. It's good to see.
It's a significant step, but we've had significant steps for 15 years. Let's just hold up.
Right. Right. All right. So let's take a minute to talk about our sponsor, Viptela. Greg, you and Ethan are going to be doing a live event on October 24th on Monday evening.
Yes, we sure are. Yeah, yes. It's exciting. So Viptela has done a live podcast with us before. It's great fun. It'll be held in the Loft Flatiron. You can get all the details if you go to viptela.com. There's a link off the homepage to the event, and there'll be a link in the show notes. You have to register. Just so we get an idea of numbers, we will be filtering a certain number of people. We want to get end users and customers in the room to hear us wang on. And particularly, we're going to be focusing about how Viptela connects clouds to the enterprise. So
that's right.
Seems relevant following today's discussion.
Yes, it does.
So we'll be recording a live podcast. It's at the same time as the ONUG conference. So on October the 24th is the first day of the ONUG conference. So if you're in New York for the ONUG conference, get along and see that. We are also going to be attending the ONUG conference on the Monday. So if you've got any ideas, you can hit us up. You can register for it. We'll have a code. If you just register with a code Packet Pushes, I think. I'm not 100% sure. Register with PP30 to get 30% off. So if you want to come along to the ONUG conference in just 10 days' time, register with that code, get 30% off, and then see us. We'll be there on a Monday, and then come and join us on Monday night where we do a live podcast. There'll be some drinks and some food, some snacks, courtesy of Viptela, and we'll be circulating around the room. You can tell us how much you love or hate the show, and I'd love to see you there.
All right, that's the Loft Flatiron in Manhattan, 6:30 p.m., Monday, October 24th, and there'll be a link in the show notes. Okay, we were talking about cloud. This is a story about Azure and Mesosphere. Mesosphere, they make the open source data center operating system for containers and microservices. They've announced that version 1.8 of DCOS is available in Microsoft Azure Marketplace. This is part of an effort by Microsoft. They rolled out an Azure container service that's built around Docker and Mesosphere. So you can choose to manage containers running on Azure instances using either Docker Swarm or Marathon. That's an orchestration platform for Mesosphere. So you've got sort of Google and Kubernetes on their end, and then Azure and Mesosphere on its end, although Azure does support Kubernetes, but it seems like it's putting more of its chips behind Mesosphere.
So it's funny how you can build a software-defined data center on top of a cloud, isn't it?
It is kind of funny.
So everybody's getting their tits in a tangle around VMware doing it with AWS, but nobody seems to notice that Mesosphere is doing exactly the same thing on Azure. So the couple of things here is that Microsoft announced that Windows will be able to run containers or a version of it this week. They're not actually containers in the same way that Linux does. They're much more like microvisors. They're not just hypervisors. They're like little microvisors that are scaled down. Do you really care? Probably not. You might not in the end of the day because you're just running for the containers. But they're not going to be as efficient as Linux containers because you're actually booting an entire microvisor inside of Windows Server to make this happen. As a customer, though, you're still seeing the same API calls. So you're just using your Docker Swarm or your Mesosphere to call those containers on top of Azure, and away you go. So, but keep in mind that Mesosphere is a full-on software-defined data center infrastructure. It's something that manages all your containers and all your storage and all your things and auto-scales and shrinks and grows the containers that you need, which is exactly what VMware is doing with its software-defined data center. Isn't that interesting?
It is interesting. And so you've got VMware moving into the cloud, sort of a closed ecosystem, and then all of these open-source projects really driving sort of that cloud-native application environment on these public cloud services.
Yep. And I think Azure is picking up the lion's share of the enterprise IT business at the moment. And every time a customer migrates from their data center onto Azure, VMware kisses goodbye to that revenue. Right?
Sure.
So but maybe there's a certain amount of AWS, you know, at least they're not going to a competitor. We'll hold on to that revenue for a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Right. So, you know, so that kind of strikes me as something that's happening here. But at the end of the day, like you said, open source, it's astonishing how far open source can stretch.
That's right. All right, enough about cloud. Now, Broadcom, they are delivering 64 ports of 100 gigabit Ethernet with the new Tomahawk.
Yeah, the Strata HGS, XGS Tomahawk 2. Who knows what the naming convention of Broadcom chipsets look like? Normally, we just talk about Tomahawk, June, and Jericho. Though this new Tomahawk 2 silicon, for those of you who are into white brand or white box switches, you should just be absolutely slavering at the bit. Now, it's 6.4 terabits per second. It does multi-layer, layer 2, layer 3, and MPLS. The silicon itself is 64 ports of 100 gig. That's its nominal maximum. What it actually has is 128 ports of 50 gig. So you can take either 128 ports of 50 gig or turn that down into 2x50 gig channels to make 64 ports of 10 gig E. And the actual underlying that is 256 by 25 gigabit per second SerDes. So I think you might be able to – I'm not 100% sure what this means for customers. Does that mean it can be 6400 gig, 128 ports of 50 gigabit? Or is it going to be like what we've got with existing switches today where the SerDeses can actually clock down to different rates so they can be 10, 25, 40, 50, 100 is what you actually pull out of the ports on the front. Just not 100% sure. The press release sort of hints that the Strata XGS pipeline, so the actual internals of the switch, has been improved in terms of latency. They've got improved the flow processing and increased the size of the forwarding databases, so more TCAM. Now, Broadcom doesn't actually put out a lot of details. It doesn't tell us anything, actually.
It's speeds and
very
feeds.
Secretive and very, it's very secretive, very closed organization, which is so it's very difficult to know what's really happening. But they seems that they've increased the TCAM and added some more telemetry for the people who want to be able to get more visibility inside the silicon, which is good news actually. So,
all right, good news if you like switching silicon.
Yes, well, you know, it's a bit the way I see it is that those of us who like silicon, and everything comes down to silicon, we're seeing a whole bunch. There's a new thing that was announced this week called OpenCAPI. OpenCAPI is an initiative to – today we have the PCI bus that connects the CPU to the memory and to the graphics cards, and people are trying to build a new memory model so that this is not what – it's actually much more efficient. So silicon still matters, right? Mm-hmm. It really does.
Of course, it does. Yes. Mm. All right, moving on from silicon to people, Enterprise Networking Planet has a story about Cisco CTO Zohar Beery Singh. He's departing the company at the end of the month. He was a partner at a VC firm and ran HP's cloud business before he was brought on to Cisco in July 2015, just as Chuck Robbins was taking over as CEO. But he is now, I guess, exiting the organization.
Yeah, I would say, judging from the tone that's going on, that he's been a victim of Cisco's internal politics. Literally, internally to the organization, he hasn't been able to have an impact and turn the organization around. And, you know, quite honestly, Cisco's internal politics is Byzantine and
that
arcane. like most big companies. So let's not, you know.
Yeah, it's not. It's just the nature of large companies.
No, but Cisco is very much a sales and success-driven culture internally, which is not always healthy. And I would suspect that Chuck Robbins hired him. He's the very first person that Chuck Robbins hired to help turn around the business. And maybe this person's just gotten tired of putting up with Cisco people and said, bugger it, I'm out.
There's a quote from the article saying, quote, being an outsider coming in without the direct, well-established ties to Cisco's engineering workforce, the challenge of establishing credibility and rapport was likely intense. So this does seem more about personality and people than it does business.
The question is, does that statement come from somebody inside of Cisco, and you know, who knows something about the matter? Or does it come from the person, or is that just the journalist making that up?
That's the journalist's speculation.
Yeah, and I would generally concur with that. So I think that, you know, he's coming in from the outside. Chuck Robbins has given him a mandate to shake it up, but nobody insists. I think he's getting plenty of pushback from Cisco to get things shaked up.
Yeah,
I heard a rumor in the last few weeks that Cisco is making headcount reductions in the teams which make hardware. And there's a lot of, like, anybody who's in the old school of Cisco are getting moved out the door, like made redundant. So stories of 30% of the Cisco fellows, which is the very top level of engineering staff, they're being just let go. And Cisco's, to a large extent, abandoning its efforts in the standards bodies. Now, that could be good. It could be bad. It could go either which way. But I think he's come in, had the mandate from the CEO, hasn't made a change. The CEO, he's basically told the CEO, I'm done. This is pointless. Nothing's changing here. I'm going to go and where I can actually make a difference because Cisco's not turning around fast enough. And, of course, that's what Chuck Robbins is trying to do, is turn the ship around and refocus the company on software.
Right. Well, he was a VC partner before he joined Cisco, so I think he'll probably have plenty of options
yes.
now that he's back out again.
He'll be landing on a big, fat beanbag of cash.
That's the nicest landing you can have.
I'd like to have one of those.
All right, let's take a minute to talk about our sponsor, Firebind. With Firebind, you can continuously monitor your ISP connection and slash network outages and slowdowns. You get detailed visibility that you need to more quickly tackle ISP issues and keep your business on track. You can use Firebind to prove network issues and stop the vendor finger pointing. With Firebind, you can rapidly configure and deploy agents in just a few minutes on virtually any system. That includes Linux, PCs, Macs, virtual private servers, even Raspberry Pis. These agents, they stimulate user activity. They perform 11 tests every 5 minutes. That means you get over 3,000 daily measurements for things like packet loss, latency, jitter, HTTP, DNS response times.
So it's an end user endpoint monitoring system. You
That's
put
right.
a little agent on your desktops around your network. They send off pings and various types of application probes, and then the data gets uploaded into the cloud, and then Firebind analyzes that data. So it's very active. So it'll show you what's happening from the desktop to the internet, from the desktop over the WAN, from what's happening across your LAN. And it's because you've got the luxury of having all the data in a single place, there's ways you can do machine learning and artificial intelligence. We've seen many examples of these types of companies come out, you know, over the last few years. That's this access to the data is what allows you to do smart stuff. So this is a really interesting idea. It's not like just looking at NetFlow data and capturing that and trying to interpret stuff. It's active probes in the endpoint pinging data across the network. It's a great way of doing it.
And Firebind, they've got a special offer for our listeners. Visit firebind.com. You can request a free trial. And if you mention Packet Pushers Podcast, you get a free month of service. So go to firebind.com for details. And thanks, Firebind, for being a sponsor.
Yeah, a month of service is good. Good.
That's,
so, you know,
that's a nice
set
way
it up
to start.
On a few hosts.
Yeah.
Get started. Yeah.
Okay.
You can see if it works for you. Yeah.
Hmm. All right. Go check it out. So a story from Tech Republic is reporting that 142,000 IT jobs were lost in September 2016. That's coming out of research from CompTIA. That's the bad news. The good news is that the overall number of IT sector jobs are on the rise.
So what is it, up or down?
It's a little of both, I guess
right?
Slightly more than twice that number of jobs was created in August. So,
yeah,
you know, give with one hand, take with the other.
I keep seeing a lot of articles about like people in the US who lose their jobs who are being outsourced. You know, the companies are moving them to outsourcing contracts mm-hmm. in India, and they're being – and I mean, like, honestly, companies are still moving outsourcing stuff to India in 2006. That just seems insane.
It does seem insane, yeah.
You know, when we know how miserable that's been for most companies. But, you know, those people are often in careers which are dead end. Like, you know, they're running minis or micros or – you know, 30 or 40 year old technologies that not every, you know, they can't translate those skills directly into something else, and they're probably going to have to retrain. So maybe it's true that there was a lot of job losses in those sorts of positions, in certain positions that are now becoming increasingly obsolete, but there's jobs being added somewhere else. Is that the way you read it?
The way they're breaking, yes, that is the way I read it. That they said for September it was telecommunications and maybe hardware manufacturing that had the most job losses, whereas jobs are being added in other, you know, discrete sectors.
Yeah, telcos, service providers, carriers, whatever you want to call them, they're in trouble. You know, we've got more financial information in the back here where a lot of companies that are starting to shrink because telcos, particularly mobile carriers, are waiting to transition from 4G to 5G. And, you know, pricing pressure on bandwidth is getting increasing and revenue is pretty much stagnant. Maybe they're looking at cutting headcounts, especially in pieces of the business, of the, you know, closing down business units that don't make them a lot of money. Things that might have been kept in past cuts because they were, you know, they're good revenue. They weren't huge, but why not?
Mm-hmm.
And today it's all about efficiency. You know, if it's not core, get rid of it.
Right, right. Sticking with job numbers, there's a story from Bloomberg about HP Inc., not HPE, but HP Inc., planning to cut 3,000 to 4,000 jobs over the next 3 years. That's to bring costs in line as the PC market continues to slump.
Yeah, so combine this with, we saw announcements this week from Gartner and IDC IDC's announcement was a few weeks back that the PC market continues to shrink at like 5% per quarter, and it's looking like PC/desktop sales will be down 12% for the year. And there's been much wailing, gnashing of teeth, tearing of hair, and you know, whipping each other with birch sticks or something, as everybody went, told you so, except they didn't. Now, I read a really interesting article which is saying, like, right the way up until the collapse happened, they were all congratulating themselves with how the desktop market was growing, even though people were buying smartphones. They're dying, right?
Yep.
So, funnily how we haven't seen – remember there was those Ultrabooks a while back? There was sort of an attempt to produce a sub-$500 PC.
Right.
And I wonder what happened to that. So, like, some of these articles have sort of been pointing the finger at why aren't they – you know, the Ultrabooks, and of course they were a miserable success. Running Windows on an underpowered laptop was just
maybe there's the reason.
Yeah, in Windows couldn't make Microsoft couldn't make a what you know a fast and efficient operating system if it tried perhaps, but you know that was something. And then really Google Chrome's come along and replaced all of that under $500 thing, especially in schools.
Yeah,
I
well actually, yeah, it depends. A lot of schools are actually still running Apple.
Yeah. I've met a lot of schools running Apple, but I've also talked to a lot of teachers who are saying, we just buy Google Chromebooks and we have them, you know, by the truckload. And they're just so easy because you can run them on a PC. People can use all the apps from a PC if that's what they've got at home, or they can pay $300 to $500 for a Chromebook. And, you know, if they drop it, well, we just replace it. You know, we try not to have too much loss, but
yes,
the cost of the asset is, you know, and Google gives them the app for free.
Right. I think where you see that, at least in my experience, is for the elementary side, the younger kids, you're more likely to be comfortable giving them a cheap Chromebook as opposed to a more expensive Apple.
Yeah. Yes. And likely.
Sticky, clumsy yes. fingers. Yeah. Give them the Chromebook.
Yeah. Uncoordinated people might be better. And then, of course, once that starts, where do you go? I mean, how do you transition back to, you know, a PC later on?
Right. I'm sure that's.
And I think a lot of people just. You know, they just use a smartphone. Why are they? Why would you buy a computer? Smartphone's good enough for most.
For some things. The PC still has a place. It's just not growing.
I can't make my smartphone. Like, my smartphone's a wonderful thing, but the idea of loading a web page and typing in my name and a credit card, it just drives me bats.
No. Right tool for the right job.
Yeah. So I think what you're seeing is HP Inc. is basically announcing that it's steadily going to shrink as PC sales shrink. And, of course, printers are still doing just fine. Like, they're still making plenty of money out of printers, but it's not a growing market, I don't think.
Right. They're just going to keep upping the price of ink.
Yeah. So cutting 1,000 jobs is, to me, just sounds like attrition. Although I wouldn't want to be working there knowing that basically, you know, it's all downhill from here.
It's on the roadmap, folks.
Yeah. Your end of life is already programmed in. Where are you going to go?
That's tough.
Yeah, maybe they need to make a watch and a fitness tracker or something. That's pretty funny, though.
Moving on, there's a story you picked up about Ericsson. They are watching shares drop after announcing some poor results.
Oh, wow. A lot. They got like the largest ever drop in the history of the company, like something like 15% buyout. They announced pretty bad results. The CEO doesn't have a plan. I think a few weeks ago we reported that the CEO was heading out the door. And once again, they've done it. And what people have been uncovering is that just how inefficient internally Ericsson is. So the slide I saw was that sales per worker has gone from $400,000 per headcount to $275,000 per headcount. So that sort of slide in sales per headcount is like key to industry. You know, if your costs are fixed but you're not selling anything, you've got a big problem internally.
Right.
And Ericsson's, you know, target number one for Huawei at the moment. So Nokia and Ericsson really under threat by Huawei, who's coming in aggressively to grow their business. They're able to do it at a cost point way underneath these companies who are European companies and, you know, built on the days when big money, big revenue, big profits, easy money, and those days are over and they need to refocus. And by the way, if it's not Huawei, it's ZTE. So there was a time where, you know, Ericsson and Nokia were very, very strong in Asia, and now those markets are disappearing for them. And increasingly, the Chinese carrier companies are attacking them in Europe as well.
Very strongly. So, absolutely, yes. Very strongly, yeah.
So they've got I think it's going to be a real challenge for Ericsson and Nokia to turn that around and to keep a hold of those service provider customers.
Yeah, they've got their work cut out for them.
So not a surprise as such. If you're sort of somebody who casually observes, I'm sure people inside the industry have got more to say. But
that's right. So we've talked in past shows about the difficulties around software patents, and earlier this month, the U.S. U.S. appeals court ruled against a company called Intellectual Ventures, which filed suit against Symantec and Trend Micro over some patent violations. Intellectual Ventures is one of these companies that actually, they don't make things, they just buy up old patents and then file lawsuits against other companies. But the appeals court said that the patents that Intellectual Ventures held were, quote, invalid because they did not describe a patentable invention.
Yeah, so this comes back to the idea that a patentable invention has to be a physical thing. It can't just be an idea or mm-hmm. a principle. Mm-hmm. And it also has to be unique and new. And quite often what people are patenting inside of software is actually not new. It's just algorithms that already existed or copying machines or processes, you know, like patenting a business process.
Just. Right, or it's an old idea that's been around, but you put it on the internet and suddenly, hey, I have a patentable idea.
Yes, and so this is and apparently I think, again, this is like the last one we talked about. This particular judge is actually someone who's been very favorable to patent trolls in the past and suddenly turned around and gone, actually, you know what? This isn't right. So I think this could be a step in the direction where if enough judges come up and say, no, yes, I agree, then we could be starting to see the end of most software patents, which would be just fantastic, I think, for a lot of Silicon Valley startups, because they waste an awful lot of their cash flow on not building products, but on legally patenting everything that they can find. Because when you're a startup investor, when you're a venture capitalist, when the company shuts down, you can actually sell these patents off and often get the cost of the company back.
That's an interesting safety feature.
Yes, but it's a cash burn on those companies, and it's also a resource burn to sit around talking to lawyers and find patentable technologies so that in the hope that you might be able to sell them when your business gets shut down.
It's so much wasted effort.
Yes. And it doesn't, software. If you invent a chip or glass or a material or a compound, sure.
Absolutely.
But if you just implement process to say, here's an online meeting app and then you patent it, that just seems pointless.
So we'll have a link to the story because it gets into some detail, but apparently one of the judge's rulings was saying that it might be better to move toward more of a copyright model like you see around literature and music as opposed to patent, so that inventors could still get some form of protection, but without all of this nonsense that comes out of all these software patents.
It's hard to know. I mean, look at what's going on with Cisco and Arista.
And Google and Oracle and all these big companies spending millions and billions of dollars on these disputes.
Doesn't take us anywhere.
It really doesn't. The patent reform needs to really be applied to the software realm in particular. But so, I hope this is some more movement in that direction.
Yes, I hope so, yeah.
All right. So let's take a break to talk about IT Pro TV. Greg, you want to tell us all about that?
Yeah, so IT Pro TV, longtime sponsor of the Network Break, for which we thank them. They've got over 1,000 hours of high-quality video content and continuing to add 30 hours a week to the collection. Courses are streamed live and on demand, so you can either watch them live as they produce the new content, if that's something that you like to do, or just watch them on your favorite device. A wide range of devices can actually see the courses, so you could be sitting there at work in your lunch break watching a training course, which is actually not a bad way to pick up on things. Mm-hmm. Course topics are quite wide and across the board: networking with Windows Server 2016, CCNA routing and switching, Red Hat Linux, and so much more. And I think I've said before that I spend an awful lot of time in my week, 10 to 20 hours a week, reading textbooks and white papers and research. And that's how I think I'm trying to keep up with what's happening in the industry, is to keep reading widely and bringing in information. And I watch YouTube videos and I've also been onto IT Pro TV to watch some of this stuff where there was areas that were relevant to me.
Mm-hmm,
so it's a way of keeping up to date, making that job transition we were talking about.
Yeah. You've got to.
Yeah.
And if you're currently signed up for an enterprise account with a competitor of IT Pro TV and their rates are going up, IT Pro TV will match your previous year's pricing of that account so you can learn at a more affordable rate. So please go check out itpro.tv/networkbreak to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 for a year, but there's a special offer. You can try it free for 7 days when you sign up using the code NETWORKBREAK30. You also get 30% off the lifetime of your account, which means it's less than $40 a month or $399 for the entire year. All right, thanks, IT Pro TV. We're back into earnings season, and we've got a couple of stories about some earnings from companies. You found a story about Fortinet.
Yeah, Fortinet had a bad week, real bad week. Got hammered. They came back to the market and said that their third quarter results were being impacted. They're going to be down quite substantially from wherever. Their third quarter results were primarily impacted by the lengthening of deal cycles as enterprises are becoming more strategic with their purchasing decisions and buying with less urgency. That is wow. Doublespeak, corporate babblespeak for we couldn't close the deals because customers aren't prioritizing security. In other words, you know, we've seen a massive surge in people running off to buy security products, and I've been predicting for a while that it's slowing down. Fortinet's come down, and the share price got hammered, so down 14%. Palo Alto Networks got hammered, and a wide range of security companies, and I've seen a bunch of articles following on from this saying the security industry is done, time to get out. So, and I tend to agree with them.
Well, I found a story of an analyst at UBS says we're coming to the end of a quote-unquote super cycle on security spending, which was marked by binge buying and indiscriminate budgets. And this was all in the wake of high-profile breaches over the past couple of years. However, the analyst is not walking away from security. He's still very bullish on companies like Palo Alto and Symantec. But as maybe the Fortinet results show, folks aren't just pitching money at security companies anymore. They're stepping back and taking a little bit more of a look at what they're actually getting.
Yes. There's been a massive period of growth. I mean, you're looking look at the results, the share prices of publicly listed companies like Palo Alto, Checkpoint, and Fortinet. Been a massive run-up, and I think it's oversold, and there'll be a pullback. Those companies aren't going anywhere. There's still plenty of room. I think I saw an article this week saying that there's a $100 billion market in security appliances alone this year. That's just security appliances. By the way, that's not other stuff that people are wasting their money on. And, so there you go.
So Barracuda Networks, they also posted their Q2 financial results recently, and they did well. The company's quarterly revenue went up 12% year over year to a total of $87.9 million with earnings of 5 cents per share. The bulk of the company's revenue, 76%, comes out of subscriptions, which was up 19% versus last year.
Yeah, they not only do they deal with small-scale security appliances, but they're doing a wide range of stuff in SME, which, you know, unusually, SME mid-sized companies growing in the face of the cloud, that doesn't follow the narrative at all.
No, it doesn't. Yeah, it's sort of sticking out there. Thanks a lot, Barracuda.
So we'll see. Those people who are all, you know, booyah, everything in the public cloud, and yet there are companies working in SME and mid-sized markets making good growth. So I'll dig into that. I'll keep a closer eye on them and see if we can find out what's causing that.
All right. Our last story for today. Last week, we noted that Verizon may be looking to pull out of its acquisition of Yahoo, or at least talk the price down from the $4.8 billion price tag. This week, Verizon's general counsel said there's reasonable belief that the Yahoo breach is, in fact, a material impact to the acquisition, and putting the onus on Yahoo to prove that it's not.
Yeah, that's just, you know, so now the counsel's involved with asking for $1 billion discount.
I bet they can get more, frankly.
Yeah, maybe. Like, yeah, they can sniff the blood in the water.
There's
got to be people inside of Yahoo going, damn, they found out. I'm so annoyed that this got out just before we got acquired, because if it had it happened afterwards, it would have been home and hosed.
That's right.
So this is just that next step. You have the breach. The announcement comes out. Verizon's in the middle of acquiring. It can sniff the fact that it can cut a discount. What's the next step? You get the chief legal counsel, the general counsel, to send a letter saying, give us a discount. How the game's played.
That's right.
Not a surprise.
Not a surprise. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that story as it progresses as well. But that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
You can find me after this mega episode. Today we've gone for over an hour, which is getting far too long for this show, really. but you can find me writing on packetpushers.net and writing in the Human Infrastructure Magazine, which I'd love for you to sign up for. We just went over 3,000 subscribers on that newsletter, I noticed.
Yes, we did.
Yes, which is quite good. But it would be really great if you're listening to the show, if you could tell your friends about it, or tweet about us, or, you know, share the show, the link on the show notes from Facebook or LinkedIn, and tell other people about the show. We'd love to reach some more people and bring some more into the family. And thanks very much for your time for listening to us. We appreciate you tuning into this.
Yeah, thank you for listening, and thanks to our sponsors, Viptela, Firebind, and IT Pro TV. And if you want to get more from us, you can find links to the show notes in our blog that accompanies this podcast. And please do check out Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. All those links are at packetpushers.net. We will talk to you again next week.